You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we continue our series of interviews with leading figures in the food sector, getting under the surface to discover what motivates and inspires them, and looking at their work to see how it's shaping the future of food. In this edition, my guest is the brilliant political and environmental activist George Monbiot, author and broadcaster of searing works on politics, the environment, food and farming. There are many ways you could describe George's work, but there's a perfect quote on the back of his new book from Henry Dimbleby, the man who proposed the new national food strategy, who says, "Monbiot has that most aggravating of gifts, the ability lucidly to point out things that people desperately do not want to be true." It's this ability to cut through, to fight the status quo and propose radical solutions that makes him one of the most interesting writers on food today. It's led him to presenting films alongside Greta Thunberg, to be arrested at an Extinction Rebellion protest, and to make, paradoxically, optimistic documentary Apocalypse Cow, How Meat Killed the Planet. Welcome to the podcast, George.
Thanks very much, Stefan.
It's great to have you here. Now, firstly, I have to say, when I read your work, I often, not always, but often, end up feeling frustrated and angry at the world, at the incompetence, ignorance, corruption, sheer mendaciousness that you uncover. So really, my first question is this. Is George Monbiot happy?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. And I think you get a different answer with every hour of the day.
I
do seem to be able somehow to roll in the excrement of humanity, which is basically what my job involves, and feel okay at the end of the day. And yeah. I think probably there's something missing. I've sort of got this disconnect in my mind because I'm able to sort of read this stuff and write about this stuff and talk about this stuff without being completely cast down and destroyed by it. Mm. And perhaps, you know, if I was sort of a healthier person, I would be destroyed by it because it is pretty devastating what I dig up every day. And I think I am, to an extent, dissociating. I'm sort of intellectualizing the issues and saying, well, this very interesting paper in Geophysical Research Letters says the following, rather than, oh my God, we're all doomed and we're all going to die. You know, it's so I sort of, in a way, sort of try to remove the emotional element and focus on the intellectual stuff. But it does sometimes get under my defences, and I do have some pretty rough days and nights. You know, we are looking at the possibility of systemic environmental collapse, the collapse of our life support systems. And I think very few people have grasped what that really means, what that really involves. It basically means planetary systems flipping from a habitable state to an uninhabitable state. And my job is to grasp that and to understand where it takes us, but also to understand what we need to do to avoid that. And while I do see the hope, you know, and I really do, as I hope we'll be exploring in this podcast, but, you know, at the same time, it's like the forces of stupidity and sort of just sheer self-destruction. Sometimes it just, you know, we have this story. We tell ourselves that we put our survival above everything else. I see no evidence of that whatsoever.
The long-term thinking that doesn't really exist, does it? Although, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, in Apocalypse Cow, you are offering solutions. You're looking ahead, and yet, you know, I have to say, I've started switching off Radio 4. I can't listen to it in the morning because, you know, combination of Brexit, COVID, political mendaciousness, environmental degradation. It's been a crap few years. And so I need something positive. Anyway, back to your life story, because let's give it a little bit of context here, because it does read a little bit like an exhausting fever dream. And you write about it very eloquently on your website. But years spent in the Brazilian rainforest, working in the tropics, cerebral malaria, beatings here and there in the Amazon, beatings at road protests at Salisbury Hill. And you've written about this and you've highlighted issues which have clearly been personally very important to you, but also to, you know, you're highlighting things about the world. The big question really is, do you feel that your writing has made a difference?
So when I started, and I've been doing this since I was 22, so it's what, 37 years now, I began with this what now looks like crazy optimism. I thought, so all we have to do is to explain to people where we're going wrong, and then people's reason and self-interest will kick in, and obviously they'll change it. And you know, I look back and think, oh my God, I'm kind of glad I was like that, because I wouldn't have started if I wasn't. But I was so naive about how people work. And my life story since then has really been a sort of ever deeper confirmation of the idea that actually, you know, you can give people all the information they need and you still won't get a rational response from it. And particularly where power is concerned. And what needs to happen is significant challenges to power and political change arising from them. It doesn't just happen through the process of reasoned argument. It has to happen through protest, through all the political tools at our disposal. So that's why very quickly I ceased to be just a journalist and writer and broadcaster, as I started off in broadcasting, and quickly became an activist as well, because I realised that, you know, just talking to people and being the sweet, soft voice of persuasion wasn't going to get us even a tenth of the way along where we need to be.
And activism sort of equals dynamism, isn't it? I mean, do you ever get up and think, oh, flipping out, I just can't do this anymore? It's just, there's so much going on. I mean, you know, because your work, once it's been put down on paper and put out there, I guess it's a sort of personal achievement having done that. Do you just want to say, okay, that's out there and it's done, and I hope for the best for that information to filter through, or do you follow it through? Is it important to you to read the comments, to respond to people's thoughts about what you've written?
Yeah, I do to an extent. I mean, I can't respond to everything, or even a tenth of everything, or even 1% of everything on some days. And, you know, I want to be getting on with the next thing as well. But I do think, you know, I think it's the great thing about the digital revolution is that you can engage. It's not as top down as it used to be. It's not sort of me handing down the tablets of stone and saying, this is what you should think. It's more of a two-way process. And especially on social media, and I do a lot of my work on social media now, almost all the films I make are made for social media. And there is that engagement. Also, as far as activism is concerned, you know, what I've come to see is that every successful campaign is an ecosystem. It's got lots of different people doing different things, playing to their different strengths within it. And, you know, when you say campaigning, people think of people sitting on the street. And of course, that is an essential part of it, which the government is currently trying to ban. But for every person sitting on the street, you need 10 or 20 people doing something else to create the whole infrastructure of activism that surrounds them. You need your radical lawyers and radical accountants and radical organizers and radical leaflet printers and all the rest of it to make a movement work. And journalism and writing and broadcasting, exactly what we're doing now, that is all part of it. You know, it is a form of activism. It's necessary. It's not sufficient. It's just one part of that rich ecosystem. But it is, I think, an important part of it. And so even when on the issues where I don't engage further, where I don't take it further, I feel, you know, it's still a useful thing to do, but it's never the be-all and end-all.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's come to your new book. It's called Regenesis, Feeding the World Without Devouring the Planet. I haven't read an advanced copy, so it's up to you to tell us all about it, really. I believe it takes on the global farming system. Can you describe the central message?
Sure. So it began when I became obsessed by soil. And it's partly because I was ecologically bored. I felt I've explored everything around where I live. I've seen every blinking species you could possibly see and every form of behaviour you can see. It's nothing more. And then suddenly I thought, hang on a moment, there is something, but it's not out there, it's down there. And I think I was very lucky, because the first day when I dug a hole in the ground and started looking at the soil with a powerful lens, the conditions must have been perfect, because the soil was damp, it was late April, things were warming up, and it was absolutely swarming with life forms that I'd never seen before. I mean, there were some things I was able to identify, like springtails and mites and stuff, but in an incredible diversity, which, you know, I would never have guessed at. And then there were all these utterly weird things. I couldn't even identify the phylum they were in. Like, what has 12 legs? You know, it's like, whoa, what the hell is this? And it was like the whole series of astonishing, mind-blowing life forms. And that just fired me up to find out, right, I want to know everything I can discover about soil. And I did enough research to have taken a degree in the subject. I read all the latest papers and I thought, oh my God, we're literally standing on what might be the most fascinating and complex ecosystem on Earth. And most people don't even see it as an ecosystem. Yeah, you know, we don't even realize that. It's as diverse and abundant as a coral reef or a rainforest. And the more we understand about it, the more we see that the health, the structure, the ecological function of the soil is absolutely essential to sustaining our food supply. That fertility is as much a function of soil biology as it is a function of soil chemistry. And that really got me thinking. And then I thought, okay, so if this is the case, you know, how would we redesign a global food system based on this cutting edge? I mean, it was, you know, in the last couple of years, we've had this incredible revolution in soil ecology, this cutting edge knowledge of what's going on under our feet. And it happens that I'd already been working with a farmer who had kind of anticipated these developments in soil ecology by about 30 years, solely through trial and error. And this remarkable man called Ian Tolhurst, or Tolly, he's actually a grower. He's a horticulturalist, grows vegetables and a bit of fruit, and had managed on grade 3B land, really rubbish land, basically rubble, just 40% stone, very, very poor land. He now is hitting the lower bound of conventional yields on good land without any external inputs to his land at all, except 1 millimetre of wood chip a year. That's it. He's got no fertilisers, no animal manure, no pesticides, no herbicides. And he's done it through an intense understanding of soil biology and through basically tweaking the relationship between plants, bacteria and fungi in the soil, and the bacteria being absolutely critical. And from there, it's like, okay, we don't completely understand what he's doing yet. He doesn't completely understand what he's doing yet. It's you know, it's years and years of experiments, but it's like sort of, okay, that's how it works in practice, but how does it work in theory? You know, we're not all the way there yet. But if we can crack that and replicate what he's doing, it's part of the answer to a greener revolution, you know, a complete transformation of the way we produce food. Because, you know, it's something people don't want to think about, but by far the greatest cause of the destruction of ecosystems and habitats is farming. By far the greatest cause of the loss of wildlife and extinction is farming. One of the greatest causes of climate breakdown, pollution of rivers, pollution of the seas, even pollution of the air is farming. And it just comes top or near the top of the list of all these massive destructive forces. And we don't want to go there in our minds because it's like, well, obviously we need farming, but, you know, we are eating the planet. We really are devouring the planet at the moment. And we can't carry on that way,
yeah.
Not least because farming itself is threatened by these devastating impacts, including the degradation and loss of soil, which is a really huge issue now, particularly in tropical nations. But we're doing our best to catch up in nations like the UK with often really appalling practice. Irrigation water, a massive issue, which far too few people are talking about. Really, really a massive issue. You know, future yield projections are all based on using more water. And yet there isn't any more. You know, we're already maxed out at most of the water sources for agriculture. The impact of climate breakdown on farming is really devastating. I mean, one estimate suggests that with just one more degree of heating, we're looking at 32% of the world's land surface drying out, basically becoming too dry for farming. We're looking at, later this century, an entire arc from Portugal to Pakistan, you know, absolutely crucial wheat and other growing areas being simultaneously hit by mega droughts. We're looking at very large parts of the world's surface becoming too hot for outdoor work. There's a whole load of these converging. Oh, plus all the extreme weather events, of course, caused by climate, which flatten crops and flood crops and dry out crops and burn crops and all the rest of it. We're looking at a massive convergence of forces which very gravely threaten the human food supply as well as the rest of life on Earth. And this should be, you know, there should be red lights flashing everywhere, alarm bells ringing everywhere. We should all be absolutely on top of this, and yet we scarcely discuss it. And that's what I want to change. And so what I look at is the sort of extreme dysfunction within the system, its inherent loss of resilience, which makes aspects of the global food system begin to look like the financial system in the years before 2008. There's some really big systemic fragility issues there, very similar to the ones we saw in finance. The massive environmental pressures bearing it on it, the massive environmental pressures it's causing. And you come out of all that lot and say, everything's got to change. And I mean, everything has got to change. So that's what the rest of the book is about. How do we change it? Especially using this incredible new power, this superpower, which we have from the latest advances in soil ecology.
So the big question really is, where does this... Well, the big question is, can we solve it? But the question at the heart of this, for me, is where does this dysfunction come in? Because we've interviewed lots of farmers on this programme. Now, admittedly, we're not going to get the massive industrial-scale farmers on here. We tend to get people who are doing interesting work. And they're lots of them, you know, trying really hard about with regenerative farming. But farmers generally love their land. The vast majority of farmers, I think, are, you know, several generations down the line. They love their land. They understand their land hugely. Why do they not join in with this soil regeneration process that you've been talking about? Why isn't it more widespread? Is it something, the agro-industrial conspiracy? Is it just laziness, or is it being stuck in their ways? What do you put it down to?
It's commercial pressure above everything else. It's just very difficult to do the right thing. I mean, all the commercial pressure is against doing the right thing, and it's in favour of doing the wrong thing. So, you know, if we look at, for instance, the intensive animal farming, which has greatly increased in scale in this country in recent years. So you look at all the chicken sheds which have sprung up in the Wye Valley. I mean, I call them sheds, they're factories. They're enormous, great steel factories with tens of thousands of birds in each one.
Yeah.
Or the pig operations in the east of England, the huge dairy farms in the southwest, for example. In every case, you've got a local buyer, which isn't really local at all. It's part of a massive multinational combine, which contracts farmers to produce to particular specifications. It says, you know, all our chickens must be this size, this age. They're going to be fed on our feed, which we're going to supply to you. You're going to build your factories to our specifications. You know, the farmer has almost no control over this at all. So incrementally, you get a whole new system has been created, which is simply devastating. It's horrendous for animal welfare. It requires huge amounts of imported grain, huge amounts of antibiotics. It produces a massive surfeit of dung because you're pouring so much grain, funneling it through these animals in these huge barns. That all comes out in the excrement. What are you going to do with it? You spread it on the fields and you say, I'm fertilising the fields, but there's far too much for the fields to absorb. So it runs off into the rivers and it kills the rivers. And we've seen that, you know, the River Wye is something whose fate I've been involved in highlighting that. But it's rivers all over the world are suffering the same thing. You know, the global standard farm is producing a global standard river. Over-fertilised, hostile to most life, the fish die off, the river weed dies off, you get these algal blooms, slime, and almost nothing else living in it. And so, you know, it's not that the farmer's sitting there saying, ha, 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 how can I destroy the planet? That's not at all what's going on. It's just, this is where the commercial pressure is tending. And it's the same right across the board. And the sort of standard solutions, oh, well, you know, we go for extensive farming instead, just don't cut it at all. There's a fundamental problem here. You know, extensive farming, by definition, means using more land to produce the same amount of food. The crucial terrestrial environmental issue is the amount of land you use. Because any land you're using for farming is land which is not available for forests, for wetlands, for savannas, for wild grasslands, for all the habitats which support the great majority of life on Earth. And so agricultural sprawl, spreading your activities over a very wide area of the planet, is the greatest cause of habitat destruction. And even the kindest, gentlest forms of agriculture require a radical simplification of ecosystems so that we can extract food from them. So it's simply no solution to say, let's go for extensive farming instead. Nor, interestingly, is it a viable solution to say, let's localize everything. I mean, there are lots of good reasons for local food production, but you can't feed the world that way simply because where we live is not, on the whole, where most of the agricultural land is. And we tend to live in big cities, in tight valleys, where there's not a lot of land. Often the land's unsuitable for the staple crop production that we need. And so, by necessity, we must import food from Canada and the US and Russia and Ukraine and Brazil and places with very extensive farmland and not many people living on that farmland. And the average minimum distance over which the entire world can be fed is 2,200 kilometres. If you were to localise farming in its entirety, most people would starve. So we need a totally different approach. And a key element of this approach, from my point of view, and in fact, I can't really see any other way in which we can reconcile the production of protein and fat with environmental protection while feeding everyone on Earth, is to take that production out of farming and put it into the factory instead. Yeah. And people react with horror. Say, oh, you can't, you know, I don't want to eat food grown in factories. Well, where do you think your chicken comes from? Where do you think your pork comes from? You know, it comes from factories. Factories are an awful lot nastier than the ones I'm talking about, where I'm talking about precision fermentation, brewing microbes to produce protein and fat. And, you know, again, people say, oh, I don't want to eat bacteria. That's horrifying. Tough. You eat bacteria with every meal. In fact, some of your meals are specifically made with the help of live bacteria. You know, we mix them with milk to produce this yellow, stinky stuff, which people rather like, called cheese. I'm talking about dead bacteria. You know, we are not just we eat bacteria, we are bacteria. We're absolutely stuffed with them. We wouldn't survive without them. And so I think we need to sort of just recalibrate here very significantly and say, okay, you know, if you were to design a food system from scratch, what would it look like? It would look nothing like this one. You know, it would not rely on using vast tracts of the world's surface to produce small amounts of food or imposing such intense environmental impacts on smaller areas. And I think we don't need to do either. You can have high yield, low impact farming, as well as taking a lot of crucial food production out of farming altogether into something which is many orders of magnitude smaller in impact than farming is to produce protein and fat.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out another edition which featured another major figure in the food world. Gunhild Stordalen is the founder and executive chair at EAT, the global non-profit platform for food system transformation. To find it, just go to foodmatterslive.com and search her name. And now, back to the chat. One of the big barriers to get through is the idea that people say, George Monbiot, rewilding, what a sweet idea, it's a lovely idea. What he's talking about here is the world's biggest enterprise with interests that run very, very deep. It's an industry reluctant to change in a way that dents profit. But we all know, and you know, we as I said earlier, you know, we read your articles and you go, oh God, yes, oh God, oh, all right. So how do we bridge that gap? I mean, you're talking about radical simplification, but we're up against neophobia, and we're up against, you know, the vast agro-industrial complex. So what is the tool for change?
These are all excellent and crucial questions. First of all, as far as farmers are concerned, you know, farmers are highly resourceful and resilient. You know, they tell a story against themselves. They say, oh, we can't change. And history shows that's so not true. You know, there's so much.
They've been through, always changing.
Yeah, exactly.
The amount of agricultural revolutions there have been.
Yeah, yeah. They're so much more adaptable than they claim to be. And they sort of constantly trying to create the impression that they're like sort of, you know, stuck in their ways when they're not. Why would they tell this story against themselves? And, you know, I've had so many farmers, you know, particularly sheep and cattle farmers in the uplands of Britain, you know, who say, oh, we've always done it this way, which is patently untrue. And we can't do it any other way. And then the next thing I know, they've signed a deal with Cargill to build a massive chicken factory. And it's like, oh, so much for always doing it this way, you know. And they basically will follow the financial incentives. Now, there is a huge financial incentive for farming the way we do at the moment, which is called agricultural subsidies. Worldwide, they amount to between $500 and $600 billion a year. And it's hard to get your head around just how much money that is. I mean, if you think, you know, there's this long-standing promise to spend $100 billion a year on climate finance, you know, helping poorer countries to withstand and avoid climate breakdown. And we got nowhere near it, you know, and it's all $100 billion. We can't possibly spend that money, you know, and it just hasn't materialized. And yet between $500 and $600 billion a year is spent on farm subsidies, almost all of which are destructive. There's scarcely any environment.
And that's our money as well.
That's our money. That's our taxpayers' money coming out of our pockets, often going to some of the richest people on earth, because the great majority of these subsidies are highly regressive. They go to, you know, in, for instance, in Europe, you know, the oil sheikhs and the Russian oligarchs and the dukes and the corrupt politicians who own vast tracts of land and are basically paid by the hectare for owning land. That's really what the subsidies are for. And often incredibly destructive. Again, you know, in Europe, under the Common Agricultural Policy, you are paid for keeping your land in agricultural condition, which means basically bare. Any wildlife habitats are classified as ineligible features, and that land is excluded from subsidies. And so I've seen the results in Transylvania, for example, absolutely heartbreaking. These stunning, beautiful, amazing habitats, stuffed with wolves and lynx and bears and birds of all kinds and insects of all kinds, being cleared solely for the purpose of harvesting European subsidies. It's just so outrageous. So we've got all this money. We're using it in the wrong way. Let's start using it in the right way, and let's incentivize the changes that we want to see. And if we do take protein and fat out of farming, we produce them in factories instead. And I think, when you get past your horror and neophobia at the idea, it's really hard to contest the basic logic of it. If we do that, then we got the potential for a massive rewilding, you know, enough to stop the sixth great extinction in its tracks, to have a huge recovery of ecosystems and habitats, and to draw down a very large part of the carbon dioxide that we're likely to produce this century. Not all of it. We also need to decarbonize our economies, but a really big part. So what do farmers do? Well, you pay them to rewild. You pay them to restore the land. And it takes a lot of work in the first instance, because you've got to take down the fences, block up the drainage channels, let the land re-wet, bring in trees which aren't there before. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to do, but you basically pay them to do ecological good rather than ecological harm. And again, farmers might say, oh, I'll never do that. But when the economic incentive changes, they'll do it. They always have. And they always will. And they're very good at responding.
And when we're talking about alternative proteins, and let's have a little chat about that now, because it is interesting. You know, there haven't been that many in vitro burgers made yet. Algae protein is interesting. I mean, Beyond Burger and companies like that are doing some extraordinary work. But it's very much in its infancy. And yet, there is still money going into the sector from venture capitalists who are there to make a profit. So it seems as though the potential is there, but it still seems quite a long way away. How do you view the potential for the industry? I mean, you're talking quite a big game about being able to feed the world its protein with this. Do you genuinely believe that that's possible?
Okay, so I think it's useful to divide this up and to think about precision fermentation on one hand and cellular meat on the other hand. And these are actually very different technologies. One can support the other, but they're not in any way the same. Now, when I began research for this book, I thought cellular meat was going to be a big part of the answer, and I don't believe that anymore. I think it's just too technically difficult and too expensive. I mean, there's several major issues which I don't think investors are going to get beyond. But there's a really simple fundamental one, which is that animal cells replicate about once every 24 hours, microbial cells about once every 20 minutes. So unless you've got a perfectly sterile medium with perfectly sterile equipment, you're not going to get a culture of animal cells. You're going to get a culture of bacteria. And you need clinical standards of hygiene. While you can't charge clinical prices for what comes out the other end. So I just don't think it's going to fly. But I don't think it needs to either, because the advances in different forms of constituting meat substitutes and other stuff have been going very fast indeed. And all the sort of, whether it's 3D printing, whether it's protein construction, there's just a whole load of ways of doing it now, which give you something very similar to meat, which isn't grown on a scaffold through the reproduction of animal cells. And so I don't think we have to go there any longer. Now, on the other end of this, you know, where does your raw material come from? And this is what the really interesting thing is, because this is really, really simple. We're using basically brewing technology. You're brewing microbes in a vat. And we've been doing that for a very long time. In fact, we've been doing it since the Neolithic. Mm. But this is just a bit more precise, but it's basically the same thing. And it's very cheap. It's cheap, it's simple, and its inputs can be minimal. I mean, in the case of this soil bacterium being grown in Helsinki, Cupriovides necator, it's a hydrogen oxygenating bacterium. So its food is hydrogen, water, and carbon dioxide. You don't need to be feeding it on plant material or anything like that. It is living off the gases and the liquid you give it, plus a tiny sprinkling of nutrients, and that's it. And so it is really super cheap and super fast to produce. And really, the difficulty is not any technical one, is getting people to say this is our future food.
Perception.
And I think there's enormous potential for that. I mean, I was the first person outside the laboratory to eat a pancake made from these bacteria. Because their protein content is so high, about 60%, we had to dilute it with wheat flour. Otherwise, we would have made an omelette. and the really shocking, earth-shattering thing, discovery we made, is that it tastes just like a pancake. It really, really tastes just like a pancake. You wouldn't tell the difference. It's quite amazing. So it's like one small pancake for man and one big flip for humankind, you know. But obviously, you know, the main aim is not to make pancakes, so that's great. But you can produce bacteria to produce virtually any protein or fat that you want to. You can then create almost any configuration of that. And you can very quickly not just replace meat, milk, eggs, the other things we get from animals, but start to design a whole new range of food we never even thought of. Just like, you know, the food we eat today was created by the Neolithic Revolution. So bread and cheese, for instance, you know, those were completely unthought of when people started eating grain and domesticated the first aurochs. You know, when people domesticate, they never thought, oh, camembert, one day we'll make camembert, you know. so there's a whole food revolution around the corner, which we can't even imagine. We can't picture what that will be like yet, but it will evolve as food does, you know. And the wonderful, mm-hmm. It's a combination of human creativity and the raw materials that food gives us will produce endless diffusion of new diets and cuisines and interesting things, which can be a lot healthier than what we eat today, because, you know, they can actually be tailored to human dietary demands.
Yeah. Now, I mean, and you have to come back to this concept of neophobia and the idea that people just won't accept it. But I always remember, you know, the potato was the future of food. It was a scary kind of ingredient that, you know, was an ingredient in witches' broths and things like that.
And that's it, yeah.
people persevered with it, and farmers were ordered to plant it in some areas, and then it became a monocrop. And then when one strain of it failed in Ireland, there was a massive tragedy. So we have changed in the past, and we do need to keep on changing. But I wonder how you feel about Michael Pollan, who talks a lot about the regenerative farming practices that you have mentioned, but he also is trenchantly stuck in the past. He says, you know, that you shouldn't eat anything that your grandmother didn't know. Mm-hmm. Now, these two things seem to be very, very much in conflict, and I wondered how you resolve those.
Yes. So I mean, I think he's a wonderful writer. You know, I love the guy. I think he's amazing. But I just don't understand that rule of his at all. You know, I look back to what my grandmother ate. You know, she was the sort of person that foodies admire. You know, she was very tough, self-sufficient to a large extent. Well, you know, not self-sufficient, but she grew her food. She hunted her food. You know, she was a fisherwoman. She gathered a lot of her food, you know, and what she ate was absolutely disgusting. it was preserved tongue. It was lardy cake. It was sort of cod, which was sold fresh in the shops and had been there for a week. It was just a really, really rubbish diet. It was very unhealthy. It was full of salt, full of sodium nitrite. Mm. It was quite high environmental impact. You know, most of what a foodie would like today, she would have thrown up her hands at it. You know, even garlic. Garlic was a foreign abomination.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Get that muck out of my house.
Olive oil was... She'd come across it, but it was solely sold for softening your earwax. It was sold in chemists, you know. And where does this idea come from? You know, how many foodies do you know are really into preserved tongue and lardy cake? You know, it's like... And, you know, what foodies appreciate is cuisines from all over the world. That is exactly the opposite of what my grandma appreciated. It was like, is this foreign muck, you know? And so there's this weird thing where we tell ourselves we're conservative about this and we tell ourselves we're neophobic, but that's not borne out at all in the way we actually eat, because actually we're really experimental and we're just constantly looking for the new sensation, the new flavour, the new texture, the new cuisine from some country we'd never heard of. It's like, thank God we don't actually follow his rule. I very much doubt he follows his rule.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about change, because if you need to offer the industry a positive direction, you're saying there is money spent already. It just needs to be spent differently. So one of the very few, I would say, potential upsides of Brexit is that it gives us an independence from European farming interests and an entrenched farming interest. So we potentially have an opportunity to shape national policies on food and farming and environmental practices. So I put you in the position of God here, or at least the source of policy anyway, which I suppose is the same as being God. So if you're in charge, what changes would you make? Wave that wand and do what you will with us in order to feed us all.
Specifically in the UK, yeah?
Yeah.
So I would say, first of all, you know, we've just, I think, just got to stop using so much land for so little food production. You know, if you look at upland sheep production, for example, it occupies roughly 4 million hectares of land. That's pretty well the same amount that we use for growing cereals. It's not far off the amount we use for growing cereals. And yet it produces just 1% of our food. That is an incredibly profligate use of land. And what it's done is to reduce our uplands to bowling greens with contours. You know, the sheep are very good at seeking out nutritious plants, and the most nutritious of all, the ones they love more than anything else, are tree seedlings. And the sheep is the major agent of deforestation in this country. You know, people think of deforestation as people with axes or chainsaws, but actually it's nibbling away the tree seedlings,
because stopping the new growth. Yeah,
exactly. When the old trees die, there's nothing to replace them. And you can still see large parts of Dartmoor, of the Cambrian Mountains, of other national parks and other areas in the uplands, where you see the last of the old trees dying, and there's no seedlings, there's no saplings, nothing that replaces them at all, because everything's been eaten. And a lot of these areas were covered in rainforest, in temperate rainforest, which is one of the richest habitats in Western Europe. Is almost none of it left. We don't even regard it as a conservation priority, and we're allowing it to be wrecked, all for virtually nothing in terms of food production. It's an incredibly wasteful use and one of the greatest causes of environmental destruction of all. So I would very quickly move to say, right, this is ridiculous. Sorry, but we're going to change the subsidies because this trade is completely dependent on subsidies. I mean, there would be no upland livestock farming at all without subsidies. We're going to change those so you get paid for environmental restoration rather than environmental destruction. And the farmers will be up in arms, but they'll do it. You know, they'll say they won't, and then they'll do it. You know,
and they'll become experts at rewilding, and then yeah, and that will
exactly,
be a
very
new
quickly.
Culture.
Yeah. Very quickly, they'll get the ecological knowledge required for rewilding, and they'll do it. You know, and they'll be really good at it because they are really good at stuff. They're practical, adaptable people. That's what they are. And don't let them tell you otherwise. Don't let them tell you that they're useless at new stuff. And then in the lowlands, in the productive land, you know, we really need to change the way we approach high yield farming, and you absolutely need high yield farming. It's essential. You know, we don't want farmland sprawling over huge tracts of the planet, but we can't afford to just keep hammering the soil in the way that we're doing. I mean, we're seeing massive losses in parts of the UK, particularly from maize farming, potato farming. So the first thing I do is say, right, no biofuels at all. You know, that is just, you know, burning food is like the ultimate form of decadence. And this is what we're doing with biogas, with biodiesel, with bioethanol and the rest. It's just like, it should be completely unacceptable to do that. Good farmland should be used for producing food, full stop. You know, I would finance a massive and very rapid R&D program to explore the implications of the new soil ecology and start applying it to farming. And I think a couple of the outcomes are going to be, first of all, don't let the soil see the sun at any part of the cycle, you know, and you're using a combination of soil armor, leaving crop residues on the ground, and green manures, filling in the gaps between crops to just keep that soil covered at all times. You know, I think it's so important. And a lot of farmers recognize this and are acting on that already. But then it's discovering the minimal inputs we can use to tweak that relationship between plants, bacteria and fungi so that your microbes mediate the release of minerals to the plant. And, you know, the fertility is as much a function of microbial action as it's a function of how much chemicals there is in the soil. Because what the microbes do or should do in a healthy system is release minerals when they're needed by the plant and lock them up when they're not. And that locking up, the immobilization of nutrients, is just as important as the release, because if you're not locking them up, they wash out through the soil and they end up in the nearest river rather than feeding your crop plants. And I think there's a huge potential for exploring all this. I would radically change the organic farming rules. I think there's massive problems with organic, just as there is in conventional. It's highly dependent on very high nutrient applications. One study suggests that it leaks 37% more nitrogen than conventional farming, which is quite an achievement because conventional farming leaks a hell of a lot. And it's because of the phasing of nitrogen release from manure. How does organic farming plug that gap? In many cases, with manure brought in from conventional farms. So it's a bit of a con, to be honest. They're using Haber-Bosch nitrogen one step removed. As long as it's been through someone else's animals, you can then put it on your land.
Quite cheeky.
And it's like, hang on a moment, that's not what we're paying for. This whole organic premium business, whoa, you know, it's like, and worse still, when you look at the Soil Association standards, it's like there's no controls on antibiotics or antibiotic residues in that manure. There's minimal testing. It's like, oh, this is something very wrong here. So we've got to just re-examine all of that. And I'm not saying, you know, these are evil people or anything, or they're trying to do wrong, or they're trying to rip us off. It's just like they're hooked into a system which isn't really working very well. So you say, you know, what would I do? Actually, I am trying to do something, even though I'm not the government. In the book, I talk in sort of fairly vague terms about this thing I call an Earth Rover program, which is the very fine mapping and characterization of the world's soils to give farmers a much better idea of what they're dealing with at any one point. You know, is my soil compacted? What's the moisture content? What's the carbon content, etc.? A whole load of questions which aren't very well resolved at the moment and can be very difficult and expensive for a farmer to get to. And I was sort of hoping that a combination of ground-based and remote monitoring would help with this. And it was a vague aspiration in the book. But since then, through pure chance, I happen to have met a scientist whose work allows us to get a long way down that road. On the strength of that, we've brought together people from several different disciplines, and we're basically launching an Earth Rover program. We're doing proof of concept at the moment. It's incredibly exciting. I mean, it's got enormous potential, I think, to improve agriculture, to make it much more fine-grained, much more local in terms of how you farm. So rather than just this one formula, slap this stuff on at this time of year and slap this stuff on at this time of year and use this tractor pulling this equipment, you can make it much more specific and precise and potentially much less damaging.
We've spoken to quite a few companies who are bringing out new tools in this area, and it does seem to be a really exciting new... precision agriculture, I guess, is what they generally call it.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about the consumers now, about me and you when we're out buying our food, because in order to create political will to achieve any of these changes, you need politicians to think, oh, God, that's what people want, we better do it. How does the individual effect change, do you think? You became a vegan 2013 or something. Do you feel that that's part of the process?
Yes, for the second time. So I was... vegan first in my 20s and nearly died of it. partly I was just really bad at it. You know, I wasn't really...
Running your diet in your 20s.
I know, exactly. And I wasn't focused on food, and I was just basically eating white bread, you know, and I went white and I lost about 3 stone and I looked terrible.
And I know just being a vegan is an oversimplification of saying this is how we change things. No. But what do you think we can do in order to make it clear that we want this?
So, I mean, definitely you do massively reduce your impacts by stopping eating animal products. There's no question about it. And there isn't an easy way out within animal farming. You know, the whole idea that organic pasture-fed beef is the answer is just, I mean, you know, the figures I was coming up with from the scientific papers I was reading, it's like the most damaging of all products because of the amount of land it needs, the amount of nitrous oxide emissions it produces. There's just a whole lot of ways in which this is a really devastating way to produce your food. I mean, one estimate was that in the US, if all your grain-fed beef switched to pasture-fed beef, you'd need 270% more land. You'd have to use the entire surface of the US to produce it and then import most of it from Brazil. Yeah, it's just horrendous. It's a horrendous way to produce food. So there isn't a good way out within animal farming. So the best thing you can do is to stop eating those products. But it's not enough just to change our consumption. You know, we do have to act as citizens as well, and we do need political change, because the lobbying power of legacy industries is always very great. You know, it's not just in food, it's everywhere. You know, it's whether it's in fossil fuels, whether it's in transport, whether it's in building. You know, you've got legacy industries whose investments are doing things in a particular way. They don't want to change because those investments lose their value if they have to change. And so they will fight tooth and nail, and they will lobby politicians, and they will pay for them. They will donate to parties, they will buy politicians, they'll fund think tanks and lobby groups to argue for them. They will produce adverts greenwashing their activities. And you can't confront that just by changing what you do at home. You have to get together with other people and mobilise for a better world.
Yeah. Okay, we've hoovered up a huge amount of your time already. So if we can just find out a little bit more. You are endlessly active and you have obscene amounts of energy for new projects. What is next for you? What else have you got on your slate?
So first of all, moving house. We're going to move to Devon.
Oh, wow, that's a big one, because you're an Oxford man, really, aren't you?
Yes, I am. That's right. Yeah, I'm very bored here. I mean, despite the soil. And I need to be closer to the sea, and I sort of need a change of scene and to explore new ecosystems and new communities and stuff, which would be great.
You're going for the surfing side of Devon or the warm coastal water side of Devon?
The warm coastal water. I'm kayaking. I'm a kayaking man.
Gotcha.
Surfing's great, but you're just going in and out in the same place.
I can't believe you said that.
A lot of people. That's going to be the most controversial.
Yeah, after everything else you've said, that's the one.
I know. That's going to be the one all the people write in about. But with kayaking, you could just sort of keep going, you know, and explore all the coastline and all the rest of it. Anyway, and then after that, the plan is, and it's been the plan for 20 years now, that the next project will be finishing my novel.
Ah!
But the problem is, you know, it's like there's always something more urgent. Yeah, and so it's like every project I've done, the next project is finishing my novel. And that remains the case. It's a bit like nuclear fusion. You know, people say it's always 40 years away wherever you start.
Well, good luck with that. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you. Let's just remind everyone that Regenesis, Feeding the World Without Devouring the Planet, is out on May the 26th. It will be infuriatingly brilliant, like the rest of your work. But thank you, George, so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Stefan. It's been a total pleasure.
And I think most of the world can say, thank God there's a George Monbiot out there working for the planet. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. For example, we've got a whole series shining a light on the many varied job roles available in the food sector. Just go to the site and search Career Conversations. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.